But in a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
There's nothing like having your own theme song, your own podcast, and your own column. John Cass, mild-mannered columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Will Lee, former leg man, left me alone, doing his own thing, writing columns and stories for the Tribune. And, of course, our friend Jeff Carlin, producer of the Rokan and Anna show on WGN. Will, what the hell is going on with the Bulls? I know I want to get into Sanctuary City and Rahm, Zorro, and all the things that are happening, and we're going to talk about Madigan and so forth, Trump and so forth. But what's with the Bulls, dude? Because I don't watch them. You watch them for me, so I don't have to.
No, I watch them even though this is one of those seasons where it's like, oh my goodness, what's going on here?
You know? Well, now let's get to the thing.
Sure.
The whole franchise is collapsing. The two stars, Dwayne Wade and Jimmy Butler, are ripping on the team, saying they don't have guts.
Right.
Then Rajon Rondo, the bad boy from Boston that everyone hated and got benched, is now siding with the gutless teammates against the two stars.
Yeah, he is. Just the big news with Rondo is he just put out the Instagram with photos of himself, Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett, his former Boston teammates, and basically put out a couple of paragraphs about what is a good team and what is a bad team, and said that, you know, at the end of it, concluded with, I'm not a bad teammate. I'm just trying to pass it on. If there's anything wrong with this team, it's not the players, it's the leadership.
So he's not really going after the players. He's siding with the ones that Wade and Jimmy Butler are ripping on, but he's right. Going after the owner and the Jerry Reinsdorf and the general manager and the whoever they are,
that's the president
and so forth.
It depends on who you consider when he says leadership. Some people think that he thinks leadership is Wade and Butler. Some people say it could be he's talking about.
Am I going to have to start watching this putrid excuse for a team? I already have two.
I don't know if you have to watch it. Only if it's on soapnet.com or whatever the soap opera is.
I've got the Fire. I was at the Fire training this week, and it was really interesting to see some of the good players they're bringing in some good players, but I'm still wounded. I'm still, you know, I'm still numb. I can't even love. I'm a season ticket holder, but I can't love them yet. And the Sox, they suck. And I just, the Bears, they suck. Some team has to step forward besides the Cubs. You know, there's opportunity for the Fire here.
If you guys could see John when he said that, you could see his teeth just completely pressed together.
Yeah, like,
you
know. Right. Kind of like Tywin Lannister having to welcome his little person son. Okay, what else is going on? Oh, okay. Here's one. The media is totally anti-Trump now, right? Let's just admit it.
Sure.
We are on a war path professionally against Trump, right? Isn't that how does that end up? How does that end up?
Well, unless we end up in, us in the media end up in re-education camps.
With the rat cage on our face?
With rat cages and other, enhanced interrogation techniques. It really comes to a head. Well, you know what I'm waiting for. I'm waiting for somebody to come up with a Trump liometer. So every time he comes up with something that doesn't make sense.
All right, look. You know that I am not, since you worked for me for a while as a leg man, you know that I'm not the ogre left hater that many of my liberal colleagues and readers think I am, but, or at least I'm assuming you'd agree with that. But there is definitely a thing, I got to say something. Everything Trump does that doesn't jive with what we say is reality is now a huge story. I'll give you an example. Hillary Clinton's email thing. She had the email scandal. The president of the United States then, the Barack Obama, blessed be his name, in Chicago, said, the first I heard of it was on the news, remember? Mm-hmm. And that gave him cover for months. And then it turned out that, there was a guy who was communicating with her on that email under a false name,
right.
18 emails, and it was Barack Obama. Was he accused in headlines and in huge stories by the so-called mainstream press of being a liar? Okay, so why not?
I think a lot of people were at that point trying to unfold, unravel, whatever, this whole cluster, you know.
It's
what.
Real simple. Yeah. He was the White House confirmed 18 emails from Obama, from President Obama, under a nom de plume to Hillary Clinton on the server.
Right.
Presidential privilege.
And he wasn't, and they said you can't look at him because presidential privilege, but where was the media to scream liar, liar, pants on fire? Why is it, here's my problem, because we don't do that, and we didn't do that, now whenever we catch Trump in a lie, and he does lie, the Trump side can argue somewhat legitimately that we have stacked the deck, we're all a bunch of leftists except for me and maybe a few others, we're all a bunch of leftists and we hate him because of his politics and therefore we're not providing good service in terms of journalism because we ignored all that other stuff. Yes or no?
Well, I think that because we didn't do it, but the media was too caught up with other, like, silly things. Like, well, when this situation you mentioned about the emails emerged, the media was no doubt concerned with something much more trivial or, you know, simple. I think the problem with what's going on with Trump now is that the lies are just, like, obvious sort of short kind of lies that you can easily kind of pick apart. Like, there's nothing to really pick apart about two different pictures. Like one with more people and one less. That's a simple enough lie that you can just say.
Or the bust of Martin Luther King or not.
Or not. Or
you see what I mean? So that was a big deal.
That's the whole
thing. Bust of Martin Luther King disappeared. I don't want to defend this guy because this guy was not my guy. I wanted Rand Paul. And I think that Trump is a barbarian, and I've said so. But our profession doesn't do itself justice when we ignore that first stuff. We say, you lied to us, President Obama? Oh, about emails in an unsecured server that the Russians could have hacked into? You know, oh, well, that's okay. Never mind. Let's go on. Let's move on.
It doesn't.
Why did we do that? By not even mentioning that, we set ourselves up. We hurt our profession. This what bothers me. It always bothers me. Am I too crazy on this, Jeff?
I don't think so. I mean,
you can say it. You can come on. You can say cash.
Go ahead, say it, Jeff. Say it.
Those two comparisons, I mean, was anything with state secret? Do we think it was a state secret there? Anything that was in those Obama emails? I mean,
I don't know if they were state secrets, but the point being, because we can't tell because it's under presidential privilege, but the point being that the president of the United States, in a critical moment, in a huge, huge story, said the first I heard of it was on the news. When that's not true. He was emailing Hillary Clinton on the bad homebrew server 18 times.
But did he know it was a home server? I mean, it's an email.
It doesn't matter whether he knew it was a home server or not. He lied about, I never call a prisoner a liar.
Sure.
He did not tell the truth.
Omitted, lie by omission.
Of about what happened. He said, it wasn't omission. He said, I saw it on the news.
Right, but
that's the first I've heard of it was on the news, he said.
Right, but he's supposed to have just assumed that it was an unsecured server or known that it was an unsecured server. I mean, he was sending it to an email address.
By the time that story circulated and was all over the news, his people would have told him or known, Mr. President, you have communicated with her. So he decided not to tell the truth.
Plausible deniability.
Not plausible.
He's a lawyer. I mean, what do you expect?
He said he didn't. The first he heard of it was on the news. That's what he said.
Right.
That's not omission. That's
you're inferring that somebody did tell him beforehand, which is probably the reality.
Whether someone told him or not, he did not type the words with someone else's mind or fingers. He did it with his own fingers.
True, but that doesn't matter. If he sends her an email, he doesn't know where it's being housed.
Under a fake name.
Under a fake name. It's fine. I mean,
right.
That's presidential privilege to
correct.
A T. But so if he has no idea where this email is going,
Josh Ernst now?
No.
This is really good.
This is the reality of sending email. I mean, if I send you an email at the Tribune.
I assume that Putin is reading it.
Well, right, exactly. So if he's going to send her an email at some email, you know, dot Clinton's, whatever it was, I forgot what it was, there is a realm of possibility where he thinks, well, this is there's no way they're dumb enough to not have a
security
email.
But not by the time the story was out for months.
Right. So somebody told him that, listen,
I'm
those emails you were sending.
He didn't tell the truth of what happened, and we did not hold him to the same kind of standard. I'm talking about mainstream news organizations, not right-wing,
right.
You know, far-right.
But it's a losing, because you can't prove it. You won't be able to prove that he knew.
What I'm trying to tell you is it's not about the proving, because you don't have to prove it to me. I heard what he said. I saw it on CBS. I heard the denial. I know that he didn't. That's not true.
But what's the point?
The point being, we go after certain things and not others as a class, as a group. I'll give you another example.
I mean, I'm not, John.
No. This is good. This is what the podcast is about,
right,
man.
I'm not saying he did one way or another. I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Here's another example. Sanctuary Cities, Willie, Jeff Carlin. Here's the deal on that. Sanctuary Cities. It's against federal law to do what Sanctuary Cities do. The federal government says, if you don't follow the law, we're going to cut your funding through President Trump. Oh my God, the sky's falling. This is terrible. Screaming, you know, controversy, dreamers. Oh my God, my God. All this hysteria. I'll give you another example. I'm the president, hypothetical president, and I say, there's a bathroom in a girls' high school in Illinois. If you don't let a man who wants to say he's a woman biologically into the bathroom with girls, you're going to be in violation of the law, and I'm going to cut your funding. And that was treated as a good thing, mostly by the media. In other words, an end to discrimination, transgender people, we should not, whatever the issue was, we sided on the side of federal force against the local government. Now, as a class, we side on the local government side against the federal government. Why is this?
Well,
how do we explain these differences here?
Now, when you say we side, I mean,
I'm saying as a class, commentators, editorials, general tone of news stories, and clearly talk show, talk radio.
I mean, locally.
Except for, you know, Prof. Danny. You know what I mean? But most of the other talk.
Right, no.
You know, right?
Locally, though, that story I thought was covered, not outside of editorials. I mean, if you look at, like, you know, Tribune, even the Herald, from a straight up reporting aspect, no bias. I didn't see bias locally. Now nationally, there are lots of different
national news bias in favor of the bathroom story,
siding with the feds on that,
siding with the Obama administration on a law that wasn't really a law, just an edict from his mouth.
Right, it was it's the same concept.
So where are we? I mean, do we just pick and choose as a? Does that tell me that the media in general is so far to the left that it cannot even see its own biases? Kind of like institutional racism, but this is institutional liberalism. Willie, what say you?
This isn't I think, necessarily always an issue of liberalism, or it's an issue of entertainment and going to the stories that are red hot. Something like this. Genders, you know, different new genders using new bathrooms and all that sort of thing. It's a much hotter story than, I don't know, something is far more partisan. It's something that
it's a hot issue that probably helped Trump win the election.
Could be.
We sided on the side of the federal government imposing its will on the locals.
We
as a class. I don't think I engaged in it because, you know, I didn't want, because, you know why? Because I thought I was going to. On these grounds, maybe I got a little wussy myself. You know, maybe I thought, you know, I could just see the hysteria building. How dare, you know, if you even stepped up and said, hey, wait a minute, what about the locals? Maybe the feds don't have this power. It was an immediate scream down. You could see it happening. Now, on the other hand, we have the mayor of Chicago defying the federal authority, defying federal law that was written years ago, not an edict by Obama with a pen and a phone, but an actual law passed by Congress. How do we, and we seem as a class to be siding on the dreamers, who wants to be against the dreamers, who wants to be against
caring
the people,
families,
the children, you know, that, all that. I just find it to be a disconnect. Will Lee doesn't want to engage.
No, it's like you said, it's kind of the thing that really got Trump elected. It's this populist mentality that this is populist. But the people believe that everyone's welcome here. If you're an illegal and you're not breaking the law for the most part, you should deserve to stay. I mean, that's a general popular. That's very popular among lots of liberals, lots of media, lots of
yeah,
people.
Because the media is lots of liberals in the media.
Right,
let's admit it.
But the public too. I mean, there are people who feel that I don't want to break up families. It's a good point.
Right. Nobody wants to break up families. Right. But there is a law. We don't want to change the law. We want to ignore the law. So sometimes we want to ignore the law, and other times we don't. Sometimes we want it, sometimes we don't, depending on our politics, not the law, is what I'm saying.
Right.
Right.
And that is dangerous and mm-hmm. corrosive, no?
Well, it's dangerous potentially, was it dangerous when the sheriffs of America, the conservative sheriffs of America during the Obama administration said that they weren't going to enforce what they perceived to be unfair gun rules, even though he hadn't really he hadn't proposed any.
Yes,
you know,
that's another one.
Right.
Or Sheriff Dart saying, "You have some property, Will Lee. John Cass is a squatter; he won't pay your rent, but I'm not going to kick him out."
Right.
And you're like, "Hey, wait a minute! I bought this building, and Cass is staying there with his grills and his Game of Thrones on TV, and he won't leave."
Sure. I mean, just like that, or just like a Republican governor saying, "I'm not going to institute any of the Medicare changes because of Obamacare, because it's going to weaken it, even though it's the law. It's the law of the land." But they didn't follow it because they didn't want to.
That was another thing, because it was the law, but then he kept changing it. But let's admit it, with his pen on the phone.
Even ridiculous. Even a law that's constantly changing is still a law.
Unfortunately, I cannot take Will Lee to lunch.
Disqualified.
I used to take him to lunch all the time, but he's disqualified now. So I need a liberal. Take a liberal to lunch. I've gotten many people who want to say they're liberal want to go to lunch. What do you think, Jeff? Have you gotten any good?
I've definitely got some good replies. We got to pick a date for this, though. I was thinking maybe the day before for Valentine's Day. I think that's a good. We can ride the wave of promotion. It is Valentine's Day.
Kind of like I love you, man.
Yeah.
Kind of like an I love you, man.
Or we could do it the day after.
Okay,
and
it's me
and
you.
Bring them. Left, like, you know, clearance rack chocolate, because that's a smart thing to do.
The day after Valentine's Day, right?
Yeah.
And we come here, do the podcast with the person, the liberal I took to lunch?
Yeah.
So I take him to lunch and then do the podcast?
Yeah.
Yeah? You want to come?
Sure. I'll bring my little
somewhere
recorder.
Around here.
We'll get a little ambient sound.
All right. Yeah, because another one just applied. Ben Burton, total liberal, big-time Section 8, the father of Section 8 for the Chicago Fire. You know, one of the guys who started the Section 8, he's saying that I need to clear the conservative wax from my ears.
Take me to lunch, I'll order up a meal. It'll be something nice, like a 12-ounce steak and a side of French fries. Offer me that cherry pie. Good God, won't you give me a slice? Take me to lunch, I'll order up a meal. It'll be something nice, like a 12-ounce steak.
If you go against the machine in this state and you're a Democrat, chances are Mike Madigan will feel it at the end of the spider web where he rules in Springfield from the southwest side. One Democrat did not kowtow to him. His name is State Rep Scott Drury. Of the north suburbs. What district is it, Scott?
It's District 58.
District 58. And he voted present rather than affirming Madigan as speaker. And now he is, I guess you're being punished.
I think that's fair to say.
Tell me about it.
So shortly after my vote of present, I sent a note. What it was that I had done and why I had done it, answering the major question they had was the time I said simply, yes, I think there will be. The next day, we had a short day of session on the House floor in Springfield. At the end of session, I noticed that there were all these gift bags. They looked like Tiffany gift bags, but they were brown instead, but they were nice. And all of my colleagues on the Democratic side were getting gifts and talking, what's in the gift bag? What's in the gift bag? And then it was my turn, and there was no gift bag.
So you didn't get a a referral for any tax reduction business or anything? It was nothing like that, like a little check?
Certainly.
Like, thank you very much.
I later learned that the gift, and the gift, look, I don't really care about getting the gift.
What was the gift?
It ended up being a crystal clock, I believe, from some shop in New York. And
engraved, like, thank you, Mike Madigan, your boss?
No, my understanding is the engraving was more along the lines of Mike Madigan, longest-serving Speaker of the House in U.S. history, 2017. So I didn't receive the clock. It was fine. I went home. Session was over. I told my wife about it, and life went on. Then we were back in session this week, signed committee assignments, and who's going to be a chairman, who's going to be a vice chairman. And I started getting texts from colleagues, you know, what committee are you going to be chairing? It's your third term. Normally in your third term, you get a chair. And I waited for the phone call, but the call did not ring. And I soon learned that I was the only third-term representative in the House that did not get a chairmanship.
What does that tell us?
Well, I think when you look at not getting the gift, which was a small,
which
I think symbolic,
yeah,
a small symbolic thing. I didn't get a chairmanship. It's a message. A message is being sent. Don't do what Drury did.
What is that? Don't do what?
Don't go against me.
Don't defy power.
You could say that. And then the other thing that happened was last year, I was the vice chairman of the Judiciary Criminal Committee. As you may know, I'm a former federal prosecutor. I worked under Pat Fitzgerald for about 7.5 years.
And you didn't work on violent crimes. You worked on public corruption, correct?
I did public corruption. I did fraud. At the very beginning, I did violent crimes as part of Project Safe Neighborhood, actually, to reduce the gun violence when we were there, and we did a good job doing that, and I think there's things that could be done in that area. So I was the vice chairman of that committee. I had put in a request to be on that committee again and keep my position as vice chairman. Not only did I not maintain my position as vice chairman, I was kicked off the committee completely.
So who told you that you were kicked off?
It came in a memo that all of the Democratic representatives received on my ride home from Springfield last week.
What,
earlier this week.
Singled you out?
No, it was just a list of here are the committees that people are on, and I got to the Judiciary Criminal Committee and looked and didn't see my name, so I looked again, didn't see my name, and realized that I was removed from that committee.
What is wrong with Mike Madigan as boss?
I don't know that it's what is wrong with him as boss. It's what I think a lot of my colleagues have allowed to happen, right? He has accumulated a massive amount of power in the state of Illinois. I'm not telling any secrets, but you can only accumulate that if people let you have it. And so there are 67 of us. Last year, there were 71 of us. And if everyone's silent, then he's just taking what people are giving him. And I think that's the problem, is that the state is not really a representative democracy anymore, in my opinion. Right now, you have too few people making too many big decisions. And I was elected by 105,000 people. I know that the way I voted was in line with a vast majority of the people based on the feedback that we're getting. And I don't think that the message should ever be sent that you can represent your district at some great expense, because that's not why I ran for office, and that's not how I grew up in this state or this country.
What is the great expense?
Well, that if you do something that represents your constituents, you may be punished, however severely. And some people have told me, well, now you're going to be less effective and you're not going to be able to accomplish things for your district.
That they want. The insiders in your district have come to you saying, I won't get this or that or this that I need.
Not even insiders. It's more just people saying, will you be able to pass legislation? And I said, look, the way it works is legislation only gets passed if leadership wants legislation passed anyway. And so after being there through my third term now, I've been methodical about it. I've learned how the system works. And I think that this is bigger than any one piece of legislation. There is a yearning out there from the public for something different, whether it's a Republican, whether it's a Democrat, whether it's an independent. They want somebody to stand up and say, I'm hearing you.
Well, why didn't you stand up and vote instead of present? Why didn't you vote for Jim Durkin, the Republican? Because leading up to that time, you had made it clear you were not happy with Mike Madigan's autocratic or dictatorial rule. It was out in the public prints that way. You were being vilified by the Democrats, by Madigan Democrats, as a tool of Governor Bruce Rauner. Why didn't you just say, to hell with it, boys, and go with Jim Durkin?
Well, because I'm not a tool of Governor Rauner, and I'm not a Republican. I'm a Democrat, and I refuse to believe that because a few people want to put out talking points out there that he is not the Democrat we want him to be, that I need to be forced to switch parties. I am confident, based on the feedback that we're getting, that there are a lot of Democrats in the state of Illinois who agree with what I'm doing. I am not taking unpopular positions. Unpopular in Springfield? Absolutely. Unpopular statewide? Absolutely not.
So what are the – where are you on the budget impasse and so forth?
I think the budget impasse is disappointing, and I believe that leadership on both sides doesn't actually want there to be a budget. And I say that because looking ahead to 2018, it is a lot easier for both parties – and this isn't my view. This is just what I'm seeing. It's easier for both parties to campaign on, we don't have a budget because of them, and we don't have a budget because of them, each side pointing the finger at each other. If we have a budget, it is going to be a mix of revenue and cuts, and then you have to campaign on that vote. And
the last alternate budget that Madigan offered was $7 billion out of whack.
I voted against it.
Right? You voted against it.
Yep.
$7 billion. So he's not really serious. I mean, that's not an act of a serious man.
I think in all fairness, John, the governor's budgets as well, and I'm not taking sides right here, have been out of balance. And so in the 2 years since Governor Rauner has come in, there has not been a balanced budget proposed by anybody. I proposed a solution. It was in an op-ed in the Tribune back in July of 2015. Yes. And I said, look, this is pretty simple. Why don't we both just come up with budgets, put them under seal, we'll open them up on the same day, and we'll debate them. And they would both be reasonable because each side was going to figure that the other side was going to be somewhat reasonable. Again, the feedback we got on that proposal from editorial boards, from people, was sounds like a very reasonable idea. So what's the reception? Springfield wants nothing to do with it because it might get us a budget.
What kind of retribution do you anticipate going forward from Boss Madigan, or as I call him, the Khan of Madiganistan?
I think if history repeats itself, I will have a very tough time passing legislation. Last year...
Or even being recognized to speak?
No, I think I'll be recognized to speak. I have a constitutional right to be recognized to speak. So if it would be interesting if I was pushing my button to speak and then they didn't let me speak. I don't think that will happen. But last year, after I took what was viewed as a controversial vote on the AFSCME negotiations, I have not seen a single piece of my legislation pass. And that's what this is about. A lot of people want to make this a battle between me and Speaker Madigan. And actually,
well, because it is, Scott.
Well, to me...
Because you stood up and said present and you ripped on him and he deserved it. And now you're paying for it.
I think
that's why it is.
I think the battle is bigger than that, though, John. I think the battle is to change the system, to fundamentally change the way Illinois government works. I last year, where it really hit me hard, was I had a high school student come to me with some very simple legislation. He emailed me. I had him come to my office, and he said, in my high school cafeteria, I just want there to be a board that says, what's in the food I'm eating? How many calories? You don't need to have portion sizes. Just tell me. And I said, you know what? That sounds pretty reasonable. Let's file some legislation. And we did. And he came down to Springfield with his dad. You know, his dad was very proud of him. I was very proud of him. And we sat in front of a committee to pass what should have been very simple legislation. And I couldn't get the votes from my colleagues to even get that out of committee. And it made me feel sick because it wasn't because the legislation was bad. It was because my bills were not passing. It's called putting a brick on the bills. And I said, this system isn't working.
Was this before or after your public criticism?
This was after my vote on the AFSCME negotiations.
Okay, right.
And so... like I said, after that vote, things changed dramatically for me. So I had to take a look at what was going on and say, okay, this is the system I'm in. Am I going to run again? Because a lot of not passing the legislation is geared towards making people feel useless, so you quit. And I said, I'm not quitting. My constituents like me. I'm going to run again. And I won by a larger margin than I'd ever won before. So I'm coming back. But there have to be changes because I'm a Democrat, and a lot of times Democrats, we vote for the speaker, we vote for the rules, and everything goes our way. But I was shown that the rules can be used against me and against any of my Democratic colleagues in a way that they can be used against Republicans. And so I can't support that.
I know that Will Lee and Jeff Carlin have questions, and I'm going to get to them in a second, but I have to ask you one. As a former federal prosecutor, what do you tell the people of Illinois, say, that they have a leader who controls legislation, controls, in essence, taxes, taxing issues, revenue issues, controls elections of judges, from Supreme Court all the way down to the Circuit Court and to various other assessor's offices throughout the state and county after county after county. And that same person also has a law business that reduces taxes for downtown real estate and elsewhere throughout the state. These conflicts of interest, I'm speaking of Madigan, are tremendous. Personally, I think they're, I don't know if they're technically corrupt, but ethically wrong. As a former federal prosecutor, looking at what happened in New York in a very similar situation with the speaker there, so-called Sheldon Silver, who's on his way to prison for 14 years, same deal or similar deal, parallel deal. What do you say to them?
You know, I don't
get... people here.
I don't get into, I'm not a prosecutor anymore. Okay?
But you had been.
I had
been.
You,
and you worked in specifically in these, not this issue, but in
Absolutely. No, I worked in public corruption, and I know that a lot of my colleagues worked in those cases, and I trust that if evidence was there against any individual, at least when I was working under Fitzgerald, that investigations would happen. And look, when I was there, Governor Ryan was indicted, Governor Blagojevich was indicted, Sorich was indicted. So I don't get into right now is what any individual did legally corrupt. Have I taken a strong look at the ethics laws in Illinois, and have I tried for 4 years to change Illinois' ethics laws? Have I tried to open up a statewide grand jury for public officials on the state side to give Lisa Madigan the power to have a grand jury? Have I done that every year for 4 years? Absolutely. Have I said people can't take gifts and change the gift ban? Absolutely. Have those pieces of legislation moved beyond the Rules Committee, beyond step one? No.
How about what do you think of the general nature of the boss of the judges and the boss of the Democrats and the boss of the assessors throughout the state being the guy who reaps rewards as a man who reduces taxes for real estate interests? What do you think of the general nature of and how, whether it's corrosive or not to the state of Illinois?
When I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office, there was something called an actual conflict and something called the appearance of a conflict. Either one got you off of a case, whether it was actual conflict or whether it appeared to the public that it was a conflict. They took you off the case because it didn't look good.
And it's not only with the U.S. Attorney, but with the Department of State and other agencies.
And I think that that's a good policy. If it appears, John, let me put it this way. I believe that one of the fundamental problems with Illinois government is people don't trust it. Okay, you and I could probably fight about revenue and taxes all day long, and if I bring everybody else into the conversation, we could fight some more and debate whether we need more revenue, whether we need more spending. But if I ask anybody in the state of Illinois, do you trust government? Do you trust what your politicians are saying to you? 100% of the time they tell me no. So every waking moment I've spent in the General Assembly has been trying to build up that trust. So this conversation that we're having, if all of these facts that you just said make people not trust government, whether there's anything wrong with the facts at all, then I think we need to fix it because that is the fundamental problem that is holding this state back.
Will Lee here, question for you. If Speaker Madigan is a part of the problem with power being shored up, you've been in the General Assembly since 2012. I'm not asking you to name names. But have you found any colleagues who are maybe yearning, who could be, you know, I guess, dissenting voices against the speaker? Or do you think people are too afraid? Are there too few of them? Or are they just waiting for someone else to kind of be the, the front runner and make the first step?
I don't think that they're there. So before I voted present, it was widely reported that I was looking into running for Speaker of the House. Did I think I could win that race when I started exploring? I thought there was a path, okay? I only needed 8 votes to at least tie up the speakership vote and send it to a runoff. And they weren't there. And to give you an example of how hard it was to find votes, I reached out to my state senator, who I work with, who I've campaigned with, and who is not in the House of Representatives, so doesn't have to worry about committee assignments. And I said to her, will you send out a message saying that you support or encourage my run for Speaker of the House? Not even that I should run, that she should vote. Would you just send this out? I got a text back. I don't feel comfortable getting involved.
Who is that?
That was Senator Morrison.
Now, I've seen many, and Senator Morrison's still in the Senate.
Correct.
I've seen many Democrats, liberals, conservatives, talk good government. And then when it comes to the, and they come to the editorial board and they get they seek, you know, they talk about good government. And we can't, this Madigan thing and all that. I'm going to be an independent, they say. And then every time, it's the forehead on the ground before their king. Every time. And it hasn't changed except with you. You're the only change.
But that is why I lost my chairmanship. That is why I lost my vice chairmanship. That is why they took a criminal prosecutor, former criminal prosecutor, off the Judiciary Criminal Committee. Because the message is being sent, don't do this.
We've been talking to State Rep Scott Drury of the...
It's the 58th District.
It's Highland Park.
It's Highland Park, Lake Forest, Lake Forest. Bluff, Deerfield, a little bit of Glencoe.
Where many Republicans live.
It's a purple district.
Are you... Do you ever think about switching parties?
I'm a Democrat.
You're a Democrat. That didn't answer my question.
Have I thought about it? I have not. I have a lot of people ask me that. A lot of my friends, I have Republican friends, and they say, Scott, you know, why don't you come on over to the Republican side? Because on economic issues, I'm pretty, you know, I call myself fiscally responsible, and people say, come on over, and we have interesting conversations, but I'm a Democrat.
Now, you also prosecuted the corrupt Melrose Park Police Department.
Yep, and the police chief.
And the police chief, Vito Scava.
Correct.
Is it the belief of the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI that Melrose Park, for years, and maybe still is, one of the, I guess, centers for what we call the outfit in Chicago?
I can't speak to what the belief of the Justice Department and the FBI is. I can tell you that we had evidence that the Melrose Park Police Department was being run as a racketeering organization, and we brought that RICO case, and we indicted the police chief, the
Vito
deputy
Scavo.
Chief. Vito Scavo. Gary Montino was the deputy chief, and several other individuals in Melrose Park.
I've always wanted to tell this story. May I?
I don't know what it is, but it's your show.
It's Vito Scott. Were you working with me, Will, when Vito was on? No, this is before. Maybe right. Jason Meisner. You know him. He's the federal reporter now, federal building. Vito Scavo was on the. I had called because there was a homicide in Melrose Park. Double homicide. Two guys who worked for the Department of Transportation for the city of Chicago had gone to a motel, stayed overnight. They both drove luxury cars while they were making very little money. And the room was sprayed with bullets, and many ounces of lead, right, were all over the place, including in their bodies. And so when I called Scavo, I said, Vito, what about these guys? And he said they were there for a day, and then they got killed. I don't know. And I said, did you check their phone records, like the phone records to the motel or any of the phone records for their phones beforehand? And he said, John, what do you want me to do? They're bleeping dead. This is the Chicago way. Thank you so much, Representative Drury,
Thank
for
you.
Being here.
I appreciate it.
Will Lee, Chicago Tribune. Jeff Carlin, who will find a liberal I can take to lunch. That won't be Drury because he's not really liberal. He's a Democrat, though. And thank you for being with us, and we'll see you again next week.